When we closed last night, I was promising to read a description of the Celtic woman in battle. We were facing up to some of the surface challenges to identifying the Celts in their origins. And if you ask me, did they remain a pure racial stream? Absolutely not. They didn't do that from the beginning. The descendants of Joseph were half Egyptian. Depends upon which genealogical portion of the mixture God chose to identify with. They intermarried all through their history in the Promised Land. But it is impossible to ignore a simple fact. Not quite as clear until the archaeology began to take shape in the mid-1800s, and the primary matters of interest, having been deciphered, made room for peripheral items, like Assyrian border frontier post routine reports. They were able finally to figure out why you have no record of the 10 tribes of the Israelites in the secular history frame. They weren't called Israelites. They were called House of Omri, with the guttural, harsh, aspirate sound, Beth Qumri, or Qumri, alternately spelled K-H or G-H. And this was a designation given to them because the sixth king of the 10 tribes, Omri, built the capital of Samaria, and the Assyrians, taking on the assimilated fact that the whole nation, called the House of Israel, the whole nation comprising the 10 tribes who broke away, the whole nation called Ephraim, came to be called Samaria after its capital city, and since the sixth king Omri founded it, the Assyrians simply referred to the people as the House of Omri, with the harsh guttural sound. Gamera, Camera, Kimri, Simri, later on as the C took on a soft sound. Sumerians, Kimarians, Qumri, all represent the same people. And about 50 years after their settlement in the land of the Medes, between the Tigris River and the Caspian Sea, and south of the Caucasus Mountains, Darius records a revolt. Border records indicate they were like mercenaries offering their services. They sided with the Assyrians on some occasions against the Medes who were pressing in, and as a reward were enabled or allowed to establish the colony of Sakasini, which is nothing more or less than Sons of Isaac, and further east at Bactria. They engaged in battle against the Lydians in Anatolia, and we have Esdras in the apocryphal book indicating that when the Babylonian regime was opening up the area to a return again, and the Persians, they were asked to come back, and they took counsel among themselves, and Esdras records they went through the headwaters of the Euphrates River, through the mountains to the north, to an unknown land, and settled at Ar-Sereth, which simply means hill or city of Sereth, and you can still locate it today. The Pontic Steppe regions of southern Russia. Time, somewhere between 650 and 700 B.C. Earliest dispersals into the area, late last days of the 8th century, highly unlikely. more probably the first half of the 7th century B.C. From nowhere north of the Caucasus, there appears on the map of history nomadic bands called Scythians, which is a description of behavior, later to be given a geographic designation by Greece. The word simply meant nomads, describing a lifestyle that Herodotus, the Greek historian, commended because they carried everything they had in a wagon and weren't tied down to any place. Speaking a strange language that ultimately finds a written expression. Culminating in Ogham in Ireland, which can only be matched with the Celtic Greek, which of all things is a Greek language written backwards like Hebrew, the meeting of two streams. They're headhunters, criticized by some who say, "Now, they can't be God's people and be headhunters. I took you last night." To David, the man after God's own heart, he didn't just cut Goliath's head off, he took the head of Goliath to Jerusalem. How's that for a... beautiful, godly, sweet-loving parade. Since we've concentrated on Gideon, I pointed you to Gideon and Judges, where they took the heads. The Celts were headhunters. And as I told you, one noted chieftain died from blood poisoning because he got on his horse and cut his leg with a tooth off of one of the heads that was hanging on his horse. That they fought among themselves as tribes didn't mean a thing. They did that through the book of Judges. They almost annihilated Benjamin. Judah, the kingdom to the south, is only called Jews, the people therein, when Israel joined with Syria, the 10 tribes to the north, are fighting against Judah. And that is the first record of the name Jew. Abraham wasn't a Jew. He was the father of the Jews, but he wasn't a Jew. The name wasn't heard of until the kingdom split. And the kingdom of Judah came to the forefront. A major race of people disappear south of the Caucasus. We're told by Esdras they go through the Caucasus. A major race of people appear north of the Caucasus, exact same date and time. Only a stubborn mind will refuse to see the possibility they are one and the same. They settle in what is now modern Bulgaria, the Sumerians. No longer any question of the root of that name. It's the Kimri, the Kimrians, called that by the Assyrians the house of Kumri, Omri, the people taken out of Sumerian bondage. They settled as tribes. One of the stronger tribes, the Moexes, in what Greece called Thrace. They worship a god called Zalmoxes, which simply means Chief Moses, who Herodotus says tricked them into believing in immortality. Their battles are reminiscent of David and Goliath. The champions tee off against each other in individual combat. They challenge champion to champion. And the wars are settled that way. The women have a role reminiscent of Deborah, or Deborah. And that's where we were last night. I said, I never read a description anywhere of a woman. If we think these men are rough, here's what the Roman historian... I had this with me last night, too. This is another one. Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus says of the gentler sex, a Gaelic woman, he says, and I'm going to say that. I mean, this is for, and I got it right here. A whole troop of foreigners would not be able to withstand a single Gaul if he called his wife. And then it tells you about her. And here's one that must have ended up in Oroville. Kiss leads to shooting. I just got that headline from Oroville. Somebody sent it down thinking that my dad ought to read this and be awake. The reason the lost tribes haven't been found is because people have been looking for Jews. And I bought a book this afternoon on Mexico's Jewish Indians, the not-so-secret Jews of Portugal, the Chuetas of Mallorca, no longer Jews, but still victims of the Inquisition, the Muslim Moranos of Mashhad, the Donme of Turkey, that's wife-swapping Muslims waiting for a Jewish Messiah. The split identity of the Karaites, the Falashas, who ask, is Zionism only for the white Jews? The Bene Israel of Bombay. It's called Acts of Faith, a journey to the fringes of Jewish identity. They've been looking for the lost tribes for years. The only problem is they're looking for somebody looking like a Jew, worshiping God and reciting the Pentateuch. God said through Hosea, they would become not my people, not having obtained mercy, scattered, and in that condition, while scattered, while not my people, while not having obtained mercy, they would reach a place of a seed fulfilling the promise as though you would count the sand of the sea or the stars, and in that place where they've been known as not my people, not having obtained mercy, there it shall be said of them. After they've been attain the multitude status. Ye are the sons of the living God. I'm telling you, the Celts are those tribes. Now, where did they go? And you already know, the purest remainder of the Celts in the world today are in Ireland and Scotland, fringes of England and Brittany. Of all places where it survived the Roman Empire, Ireland. And yes, I will get to St. Patrick before St. Patrick's Day this coming week rolls around. Did he really drive all the snakes out of Ireland? There are some people that think there was more than one spiritually oriented leader, all merged into the legends and history of St. Patrick. But I don't think you ought to come upon St. Patrick's Day this year without knowing what it's all about. Yeah, I will, for Ethel Clemence's sake, if no one else, read the description of the Celtic woman. There is one thing that everybody that the so-called authority on Celts agrees. They don't know where they came from. They just appear on the scene, 7th century B.C. This National Geographic, May 1977, the Celts, it says, Europe's founders. And it speaks of today's Celtic revival. Are you aware that all this has happened since the 1800s? That message come across to you? And if what some Bible scholars believe, just as there was a time on God's calendar for the Jews, the tribes to the south, to be in bondage in Babylon, God set a time on the punishment and the lostness of the 10 tribes to the north. And if that time is a little in excess of 2,500 years, about 1770, 1780 A.D., you could expect a change. Winckelmann, in his writings on Pompeii, really fathered modern archaeology. Schliemann tore the world apart, and they had to rewrite all their books when he found Troy. And Homer had to be read again. Legend was no longer simply legend, but was based, Homer's Iliad, in historic fact. Schliemann found it because he trusted Homer more than he did the big mouths in the know-it-all professions. The burst of archaeological knowledge, Body and Lollard uncovering Nineveh and their great digs, when the Arabs thought Nimrod rose from the dead out of the desert. The uncovering by George Smith and the finding of the remainder of the jigsaw puzzle that represented the Babylonian account of the flood, the Gilgamesh epic. All that got attention, and then they began to take the smaller things apart. The unknown Hittite empire. Now we know that the braggart Pharaoh in Egypt, who claimed the victory, was defeated at Kadesh. And that Palestine had been devastated by wars between the Hittites and the Egyptians, equivalent to the 30 years war in Egypt. And it was that treaty between the Hittites and Egypt that set the stage for the rise of Saul and David's kingdoms. The history books simply note that Egypt was ruled for about 300 years by shepherd kings, the Hyksos. That's the Grecian designation. All history will tell us is they had mastered the chariot and were super horsemen, and that they came from Palestine, Canaan land. And they're called shepherd kings. Interestingly enough, the date is exactly the same time span as when Joseph rose to power in Egypt, brought his family down, and when Pharaoh asked them who they were, they said, "We be shepherds, both our and our fathers." Some people think, as we've been saying the last two nights, 70 people came blundering down there with 10 raggedy tents. Jacob was a king. The Egyptians hated him. And the record of the feast before Joseph had revealed himself to his brother, and the Egyptian says, "We won't eat with Hebrews from the land of the Hebrews." If they were the only 70, and if they were nobodies, how come the whole land was named after them? Labarnus, the first king of the Hittites, the rise of the Hittite kingdom, unknown until this century, exactly coincides with the powerful Laban and the descendants of Abraham who settled at Haran, named after Abram's son. You don't have to go very far to find Laban and Labarnus, the first ancient king of the Hittites. Jacob was a king. The land was known as the land of the Hebrews. You find that when Joseph revealed to the chamberlain where he came from. And Joseph was made the total ruler of Egypt. He took all their money, all of their cattle, all of their land, and bought them and moved them around like checkers to places and says, now farm and give 20% of what you make to Pharaoh. And the funeral procession back to Canaan for Jacob, Joseph's father, was so great that it took all the rulers of Egypt with him, and the Canaanites named the place the Mourning of the Egyptians. Not the mourning of the Hebrews, the mourning of the Egyptians for Jacob. And he blessed Pharaoh, proving a superiority. Undo your Sunday school teaching and get it right. The Israelites were not in bondage for 400 years. They went into bondage when a Pharaoh rose up that knew not Joseph. When the Hyksos, the shepherd kings, were thrown out in a war in Egypt, and the remainder Israelites were enslaved. They were the rulers. The scripture says they were mightier than the Egyptians. And when they were thrown out, a portion remained in bondage. Josephus calls Darda the son of Zara Dardanus. Dardanus founded Troy. Within 30 years after the shepherd kings were overthrown and pushed out of Egypt. Too many accidents. Just too many accidents to write them off. And we follow that great grandson of Dardanus out of Troy, Brutus, in the old British Chronicles, to the founding of a kingdom in England. And we've got two things we're searching for in God's book. While they were in Egypt, they were divided. And Jacob took the promises that had been given to Abraham and he split them. To Judah went the scepter and the lawgiver. To Joseph went the remainder of the birthright through Ephraim, which included multiplied kings and a commonwealth of nations. And ever after, that separation remained until they split into the two kingdoms. In the days of Rehoboam, and Jeroboam becomes the king of the kings of the tribes of the north. They're carried into bondage in Assyria. Judah's carried into bondage in Babylon. Yet Ezekiel 37 sees the dry bones of Israel rise again. And God says to Ezekiel, take two sticks, and on one stick write Joseph, and on the other stick write Judah, and join them together, and they shall be one stick, and they shall have one King David. Not enough for Judah to return. God's never lost the tribes. But before the ending of the kingdom of Judah, God, one of three that I know, sanctified in the mother's womb before birth, Jeremiah, is singled out by God, sanctified before he's born, and appointed trustee over the promises of God, set over the nations. There were only two of them, Israel and Judah, that God was concerned about, and given the assignment to tear down, uproot, destroy, and remove, but also to plant and to build. Promised by God he'd have his life for a prey wherever he went. Promised by God that his enemies would be good for him and look out for him, and he would pass with his enemies to an unknown land. His servant Baruch told that he would have his life for a prey. No man would take it from him. He'd die a natural death. Everybody that studies in the evangelical frame knows Jeremiah was the uprooter. Five successive kings, he prophesied their destruction. When Nebuchadnezzar comes and blinds Zedekiah and slays his sons before he blinds him in front of his eyes, the kingdom of David was cut off, yet God had said to David, if your sons sin, I'll still not lie to you. There will always be of your lineage on the throne, and there will always be a throne, a dynasty, and your seed ruling. That's why Tom Paine lost his faith. If those promises can't be found carried out, God's not faithful to his word. The daughters of Zedekiah, granddaughters of Jeremiah, remain in a little band and go with Jeremiah to Egypt. God prophesies absolute destruction except on those that escape. Where did Jeremiah escape to? With him is the remainder of the Zedekiah line, the daughters of the king. Of the seed of Zarah is a king sitting on the throne in Troy with descendants who've gone to England in later years. Dan and Simeon left their sea coasts long before either kingdom was carried into bondage to open settlements. The 10 tribes, as we've said, according to Esdras, went through the Caucasus Mountains. Where do you think we get the name Caucasian? Caucasus Mountains. Now we have to put together the seed of Judah, the seed of David. We have to find out what happened to Zarah's sons, that dangling twin son of the breach. And we have to find these lost tribes that have never been lost to God, have only been lost to themselves and to the fishers and hunters that God prophesied would go after them, because they looked for the wrong characteristics. They are not Jews. They become a part of the Gentiles. It is of the Celts, the 10 lost tribes that came back around across the Dardanelles and settled at Galatia, a tribe of 20,000 of them, that were the Galatians to whom Paul wrote in the New Testament. Jesus knew the lost tribes existed. And in Romans 9, the glory of God in carrying out His word among the Gentiles is clearly named by Paul, as he quotes Hosea, as being fulfilled in the house of Joseph, Ephraim, those 10 lost tribes. Now the Celts appear north of the Caucasus, and they have all the characteristics necessary. But I told you to tell you about the woman. Well, let's read this one. You interested in this? Here's a Roman picture. Nearly all the Gauls are of lofty stature. The Romans called them Galli. The Greek called them Keltoi. They are the same. Sumerians, Scythians, the nomads who appear in the 7th century B.C. north of the Caucasus. Nearly all the Gauls are of lofty stature, fair and of ruddy complexion, terrible for the sternness of their eyes, very quarrelsome, and of a great pride and insolence. A whole troop of foreigners would not be able to withstand a single Gaul if he called his wife to his assistance, who is usually very strong and with blue eyes, especially when swelling her neck, gnashing her teeth, and brandishing her sallow arms of enormous size, she begins to strike blows mingled with kicks, as if there were so many missiles sent from the string of a catapult. My mother's red-headed, you know. If I were my dad, I'd be careful. You know, he became known as a kissing pastor. I think one of them's up in Warville. Kiss leads to shooting. This was sent down from Orville. An elderly Orville woman told deputies who arrested her Sunday that she shot her husband because he pushed her and yelled after seeing her kiss the pastor at church. Deputy said Lizzie Hannah Jones, 84, admitted shooting her husband Harrison Jones, 81. The woman said she fired twice with a .38 revolver she carries in her pocket. The first shot missed, second shot dropped Jones to the living room floor. She described herself as very church-going and told deputies Jones got upset when he saw her kiss the pastor. He says, I tried to tell him it was in the Bible, but he kept pushing me and shelling and yelling. Deputies were able to talk with Jones long enough at the hospital to learn he didn't want to press charges. She told the deputy she didn't want to kill him, just for him to leave her alone. I don't know if she's a Celt or not. I could do a lot with that. A Gaelic woman, this woman says, is a match for a whole troop of foreigners. Steely-eyed, she swells her neck, gnashes her teeth, flexes her huge white biceps, and rains wallops and kicks as though from the twisted cords of a catapult. Yeah. ERA. Women's liberation. Now, where did the Celts come from? Where'd they come from? Where'd they come from? Who were the Celts? What were they like? The Celts were a group of related tribes linked by language, religion, and culture. Hoop-de-doo. That's what they always were. That gave rise to the first civilization north of the Alps. They emerged as a distinct people in the 8th century B.C. They're stretching it a bit. About the time Homer was composing his Iliad. Here they go, riding on chariots. They could run the length of the chariot tongue between the horses and run back on the chariot and never lose their balance in the middle of a fight. They wanted to hit somebody on the head. I mean, they were mean. Who were the Celts? It was probably the best book on the subject. The Celtic world. Barry Coonleaf, professor of European archaeology, University of Oxford. Physically, the Celts are terrifying in appearance, with deep sounding and very harsh voices. In conversation, they use few words and speak in riddles, for the most part hinting at things and leaving a great deal to be understood. In that sense, I'm Celtic. They frequently exaggerate, never me, they frequently exaggerate with the aim of extolling themselves and diminishing the status of others. They're given to bombastic self-dramatization, and yet they're quick of mind and with good natural ability for learning. They have also lyric poets whom they call bards. They sing to the accompaniment of instruments resembling lyres, sometimes a eulogy and sometimes a satire. Diodorus Siculus, written in 1st century B.C. That was his description. The Celts were the inhabitants of Europe in the pre-Roman period. Well, hoop-de-doo. They were barbarian in the classical sense of the word, which simply means they spoke a language other than Greek. It was the barbarians who called them barbarians. You have any idea what the Chinese call you? Their craftsmen created a brilliant art style, and by the 1st century B.C., a truly urban society had begun to develop in many areas. Every promise of God, we got 36 of them written down. Concerning these tribes, we'll find fulfillment in these Celts. That's why we are studying them. It was against these people that the Roman armies moved in the 1st centuries B.C. and A.D. leaving only a Celtic fringe in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and Brittany to survive unconquered. The study of Celtic achievement and all its diversity acquaints us with a people too often dismissed as barbaric, too long neglected and misunderstood, a whole civilization many faceted with an underlying unity. Isaiah said, "Keep thou silent, O islands, and let the people renew their strength." Now, somebody watching for the first time say he's a British Israelite. No, I'm not. Not in the cultic sense, but in the courageous belief that God's word, as Schliemann was sure Homer would be borne out, God's word will be borne out. These people have never been lost to God. These are those descendant tribes of the 10 tribes that moved through the Caucasus Mountains. And the fringe, Ireland, Scotland, and England, is where the purest expression and longest lasting culture made its last stand, and to there we must look for the biblical fulfillments that let us be able to look at God's word and find God is ever faithful to his word, and we don't have to take the ridiculous extremes that some of the earlier British Israelites took in cultic theology to find the faithfulness of God's word. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. In the 4th century B.C., Ephorus claimed that there were four great barbarian peoples in the known world: the Libyans in Africa, the Persians in the East, and in Europe, the Scythians and the Celts. Who are the Scythians? The nomads who stayed north of the Black Sea long enough for the Romans to give them a geographic territory name. They are the same people. And the Celts are the Scythians who moved and were given the name Celtoi by the Greeks. The original, the Celts, Celtoi in Greek, were by then, that is the 4th century B.C., well known to classical writers. The earliest reference to them was in an early 6th century B.C. account of coastal travel from Cadiz and Marseille. The original document has long since disappeared, but by a remarkable chance it's quoted in a coastal survey compiled by Festus Rufus Avienus, Roman proconsul of Africa in A.D. 566. Though obscure in detail, it gives clear impression that peoples who could be classed together as Celts lived close to the North Sea in France and in the southwest of Spain. This geographical spread is to some extent confirmed by Hecataeus of Miletus, who was writing about 500 B.C. Tantalizing and imprecise though these scraps of evidence are, the general impression to be gained, remember the geographic, which is usually a popularized account and moves to the remote boundaries because of what they think are found in Hallstatt culture of identity, they push it to the 8th century B.C., 700. Here, probably the finest study on the Celtic world in prints says it clearly. Tantalizing and imprecise though these scraps of evidence are, the general impression to be gained is that by about 600 B.C., most of Western Europe, from Austria to the Atlantic, was occupied by tribes who were sufficiently similar in thought of as a culturally one people. Or read that again. By about 600 B.C., most of Western Europe, from Austria to the Atlantic, was occupied by tribes who were sufficiently similar to be thought of as culturally one people, and who probably referred to themselves by a name which, when translated into Greek, sounded like Celtoi, but nobody knows what they referred to themselves as. First place, nobody knows how the Greeks pronounced Celtoi then. So we don't know what name they gave themselves. How and when this cultural unity emerged can only be assessed by considering the archaeological evidence for man's development in Europe from the 6th to the 1st millennium B.C. Sometime within this span so crucial to the history of the world must lie the ethnogenesis of the Celts. And I'll tell you what they go on to do then. They find the proto-Celtic predecessors. They trace it through Neolithic cultures, megalithic structures, bronze beaker urn fields. But about all they can really be sure of is the urn field culture distinguished from the Celts by their burial practices. They cremated and put them in urns. So a field of urns is urn field. You know how to remember the culture. Suddenly the Celts show up burying their leaders in wagons with the harness of their horses and their weapons. When do the Celts show up? 7th century B.C. Overpowering the urn field culture, overpowering the natives, coming in powerful warlike tribes to rule and move at will across Europe. Now, where'd they end up? Here's a map of their tribes. If you'd like to take a quick look at it across Europe, in those shaded in places. Notice down here in Thrace, where the heavy settlement of the Moesies originally, the worshippers of Zalmoxes, they're called Dardani. God had said of Dan, Dan will judge his people. Just means not just judge like sit up and pass judgments guilty or not guilty. A judge also designates the record. He is the authority to determine upon deliberation and decision. What's what? The judge can determine to whom an inheritance belongs. He signs it with his name. Wherever the tribe of Dan went, they leave their seal. Just as D, there's no vow. Some people try to say it comes from the Celtic word that means fort. Or strength, or power. Well, what's wrong with the designation word of Dan? Since the Bible clearly says the tribe goes, and everywhere they went, they sent men out, 600 of them. There was a city there known by name, one name. When they finished, it was called a name that included Dan in it after their father. Shall leave a trail like a serpent, the prophecies of Jacob said. Literally, when it says Dan shall judge, what it really is saying in the original, because the same word, Dan shall Dan, which means everywhere Dan goes, it Dans. Dnieper, Dniester, Danube, Dardanelles, Macedonia, London, and the circular forts reminiscent of the way they were built among the tribes of Israel. All over Ireland, the last jumping-off place from tribes driven to that point in Ireland. Where did they come from? Well, we know the 8th century B.C. was a crucial time for the emergence of the Celtic people. We know that in this period, the nomadic and semi-nomadic tribes whose traditional homeland lay in the steppe lands fringing the north shores of the Black Sea. Peoples known to the Greek writers as Sumerians, that's Beth Cumri, that's the Kimri, that's the Gamera, referred to in the Assyrian border posts. The 10 tribes were coming under increasing pressure. Scythians, that's nomads. One branch penetrated Anatolia. Throughout the 7th century served as a mercenary army. We read that the other night from Syrian border post inscriptions that was determined. Another group seems to have moved off westward into Europe, spreading along the Danube into Bulgaria, where their burials with echoes of their Pontic, southern Russian steppe, they say. Now, nobody was digging up any of these things. The world was dominated with the German viewpoint of the Greco-Roman world. Nobody looked for a culture among, quote, the barbarians. Then the Celts were discovered, technically highly skilled. By the 7th century B.C., they had mastered all the techniques necessary to work bronze. The extraction and forging of iron soon became widespread. In short, the surviving material remains of the Celtic culture show that society was endowed with technology and the craft skills unsurpassed in Europe until the 18th century A.D. It was in Ireland, protected by the wild Irish Sea from the destructive effects of close contact with the European mainland, that the spirit of the Celts flourished and developed. Here, the four cycles of stories remain. The first are the, quote, mythological stories about the tribes of the goddess Danann, Baloney. Tuatha De Danann means tribe of Dan, period. Homer's stories were said to be mythical. We now know better. 6th century saw a distinct shift from Urnfield culture to the Celts. By the middle of the 5th century, a shift of focus north and west can be detected. I'm just picking highlights. 3 centuries from about 700 to 400 B.C. saw the emergence and the fall of a rich aristocratic culture in the very heart of the Celtic world, occupying a zone from Bohemia to Burgundy. Of the centers of wealth and power in the Hallstatt and early Latine world, 2 stand out. And those Hallstatt and Latine refer to 2 original digs in Hallstatt in Austria, Latin, when a lake drained down low and they found near Bern, Switzerland, underneath the water, the remains of a culture, the Latin, a bit later than the Hallstatt. It's now come to represent not a geographic location, but rather a dating of time. And they've broken it into Hallstatt A and Hallstatt B and Hallstatt C and Hallstatt various time zones as they've dated it from tree trunks to coordinating pottery with the Grecian world, followed by Latin. When did this digging begin? Get ready, you that have been listening to me every night. When in the early years of the 19th century, 1800s, the great Danish archaeologist, blah, 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 in 1846 on the shores of Lake Hallstatt in Austria, amid the magnificent mountain country of the Salz Kammergut, George Ramsauer, director of the Hallstatt State Mine, began to excavate the graves of a prehistoric cemetery where a flourishing community had buried their dead in the first half of the first millennium B.C. Between 1846 and 1862, he uncovered no less than 980 bodies. In 1876, the Vienna Academy of Science began to excavate the nearby prehistoric salt mines. The finds were spectacular. Then comes the discoveries at Latin. Meanwhile, in Switzerland, another important discovery was being made at Latin on the banks of Lake Neuchâtel. At the northeastern end where the river Tiel flowed into the lake, a lowering of the water level in 1858 revealed lines of blackened timbers projecting from the mud. Now, do you really think, you that have been listening to me week after week, do you really think these dates just fell out of the sky? Until Schliemann dug, middle of the 19th century, 1840, 1850, 1860. How many times have those dates leaped out at us? Nineveh's uncovered. Troy is uncovered. Assyria's uncovered. The summer capital of the great Akkadian and Sumerian and later Persian kingdoms uncovered. The Hittite kingdom found. The Celtic civilization, heretofore considered barbarians and written off by the German Greco-Roman dominated worldview. the Darwinian evolutionary theory had moved into social studies, and man had to progress from barbarian to civilization, and no deviation was allowed. Archaeology blew it apart, 1800s. What if these tribes were to, as Isaiah said, keep thou silence, O islands, and let the people renew their strength. They were not to know who they were. They were not to look like God's people. They had been given a bill of divorce, as Hosea said. Yet they would grow to a multitude of people, and out of them would come multitudes of kings and a commonwealth of nations. This isn't going to change my Christian faith any more than Paul should stop being a Christian and go back to being a member of the Sanhedrin. But it's sure going to strengthen my faith in God's promises based upon his dear son. If God will be faithful to his word with a miserable, divorced, unfaithful people like this. And as I said last night, shocking as it sounds, Ezekiel 23 makes it clear they were the happy hookers of Egypt. Both of them. All Jacob did was voice the division that was already there since Leah and Rachel. I ask you that listen. I'm not telling some of you anything I haven't told you before piecemeal. But each step that we take, which is why if you're picking up late, just give me some time, the reviews will pick you up. I believe in the Gestalt theory of learning. You hit you with the whole ball of wax, it'll come through eventually. And as we hit it from every side and every source, before we were willing to say, yes, those Scythians and Sumerians north of the Caucasus and around the north and western side of the Black Sea were the lost tribes re-emerging. As I moved to Ireland, and as we face up to the fact that centuries of Christian teaching were without the benefit of the discoveries that came about some 2,500 years after they were carried into bondage. It deserves another look to see if the old Leviticus statements of the time of punishment would reach to that almost exact time in history when the United States would break forth from the British Empire. And what is the greatest empire the world has ever known, and what today is the most far-reaching monarchy the world has ever known, would survive that breaking, take its new shape, and design a monarchy that to the mysticism of anyone or the mystery to anyone who studies history could survive in a cynical modern world. That monarchy is still ruling wherever the sun sets over the largest community of nations the world has ever seen. Now that isn't going to make me go to the extremes of the British Israelites any more than I want to move to Israel and live on a kibbutz and forsake Christianity and become a Jew. But God's word comes alive because God said there would be multiplied kings come out of the descendants of Abram and Jacob, and particularly Joseph. There have not been multiplied kingdoms and kings in a commonwealth of nations come out of the Jews. Never has. God said David would never want one of his seed to sit on a throne ruling over Israel somewhere in this world every moment from the moment that declaration was made. God said, as long as you see the sun in the sky and the moon in the sky, there'll be of the seed of David on a throne over the children of Israel. The tribes are lost, and if the kingship was lost, God's a liar, and I'm going to quit preaching his book. Some of you need to face up to a lack of courage in believing that God's book would be borne out. Jeremiah was not only commissioned to tear down, uproot, destroy, and pull down. He was commissioned to plant and to build. Where did he do it? Where has David been ruling over the tribes? Where are the tribes? They're the Celts. They went to Ireland. Simple as that. Let's go to Ireland. Exactly when the Celts started coming to Ireland. This is one of the finest little books I've ever read on Ireland. John Ranelagh. Ireland, an illustrated history. Who is this guy? It's Oxford University Press, but who's the author? Sends it to, he writes it, dedicates it to his mother and his father. Who is this guy? Remember, one of the oldest families in Ireland, a direct descendant of the 16th century Gaelic leader Fiach McHugh O'Byrne. Okay, that qualifies him, I guess. In the early 1970s, while preparing a doctoral thesis on the origins of the Irish Republican Army, he interviewed many of the surviving leaders. Of early 20th century secret paramilitary and political groups which helped to create Erie. His work has preserved a great deal of evidence which might otherwise have been lost. Okay. He says, exactly when the Celts started coming to Ireland and whether they came in peace or as conquerors is not clear. Two groups of Celts populated the British Isles, the Gaels and the Brythoni. The Gaels occupied Ireland and some of Scotland. The Bronze Age settlers had never been slow to adopt to new metallurgical discoveries, so it's difficult to be certain at which point they were superseded by the Celts' iron culture. But by 500 BC, Ireland was probably a completely Celtic country, enjoying the widespread use of iron implements. The Celts themselves seem to have originally come from the lands around the Caspian Sea. All I'm wanting to do is catalog the multitude of voices now, and they're not British Israelites. The Celts themselves seem to have originally come from the lands around the Caspian Sea, migrating there in stages in all directions. Okay, what else do you say? The first historical mention of the Celts dates from the 6th century B.C., when they're recorded as being in France and Spain. Earliest known written evidence of Ireland comes from a Carthaginian sailor, Hamilco. Gaelic Celts possessed a highly sophisticated society and they rapidly made their mark on Ireland. Gaelic society was tribal in organization. The Gaels differed from other Celtic tribes in maintaining the system of kingship for so long. They burst on the scene with a fully operating monarchy and with a kingship ideal not based solely on power, but on the qualities of kingship required for one to rule. They remained a series of tribal monarchies right into the Middle Ages. They had a twofold headship, a prophet, priest, religious, seer, 20 years in training, memorizing the secrets. They met in feasts where all the tribes would come together in annual feasts that would bring them together, and the history and exploits of the tribes would be recited by the Alums and later the Druids. And Druid simply means, comes from the D and the R, the root words for oak. Too many people are prone to think of Palestine only as Cedars of Lebanon. Where did God talk to Abraham, their father? At an oak in Mamre. Here's a little book, Nora Chadwick. I've been reading from it. Professor of Anglo-Saxon in the University of Cambridge. Most of her life was spent doing research, mainly into the Celts. Remember, she's the one. I said, I'm going, surely she can tell me where they came from. And you know what? She didn't know either. She just says, they appeared. They just appeared. They show up. I want to read you something. Such then are the Celtic peoples. This is Nora Chadwick, Pelican Original, the Celts. Such then are the Celtic peoples who developed in Central and East Central Europe toward the middle of the 7th century B.C. Isn't that strange, these dates? In what corresponds archaeologically to the early Iron Age or the period of Hallstatt culture, and who conquered and settled most of Central and much of Southern Europe from 500 B.C. until the Roman conquest of Gaul by Julius Caesar. They are the chief people of prehistoric Europe in its closing phase, which corresponds archaeologically to the period known as Latin. Their essential homogeneity can be seen from the name Celtoi, by which they were known to the Greeks from the 5th century. The Romans called them Galli, and at a later time the term Galatia was commonly used by both Greek and Roman writers. Herodotus twice states that the river Danube has its source in the land of the Celts. How interesting. Hoop-de-doo. In the latter part of the 2nd century B.C., a people known as the Cimbri, check your dictionary, it's alternate pronunciation, Cimbri, Cimbri, made a series of incursions from their home. Whatever the original nucleus of the Cimbri or Cimbri, they were joined by people known as Teutones. How many know that the word, you've got enough German background in language training, Hebrew, to know that the word for German comes from a word in the Latin, it's a cognate word that comes over from another language that simply means and distinguishes genuine. So, a genuine distinction of a Scythian group to distinguish them from some non-genuine Scythians. This word Teutones is itself cognate with a Celtic common noun, Tuatha. Tuath, Ireland Tuatha, Welsh Tud, people or tribe. Here come the Scythians, which means nomads. After a while, later Romans referred to them geographically. Here come the Teutons, which simply means tribes in another dialect. Later on, because it's a certain river on the other side of it, they designate them by a geographic area. It's the same wandering nomads. You say the intermarry? If they're like their granddads, they did. I mean, they didn't change much. They still hunt heads. They still fight. The women are still fearsome. Our evidence on the whole, this expert says, suggests that the Teutons or Germans were a division of the Celtic or Celtic people. The Cimbri seem to have first turned eastward, attacking the Celtic tribes of the Boii. Who were the Helvetii, from which Switzerland's founding tribes and Helvetia takes its name, Celts. The classic area on the continent established by the Celts was, of course, Gaul. Caesar kept journals of his conquering of Gaul and his records of the Gallic Wars give us one of the best first century pictures of them. But the Gaulish people did not enter Gaul as a single nation. They entered as tribes. How do you think they went into the Promised Land? The Allobroges spread from the Rhone to the Alps. The Sequani occupied the plateau of the Jura. The Aedu held from the Saône to the plateau of Autun, down again towards the rivers of South France. Gradually, in the course of conquest, they formed political and military unions. Can't you read in the book of Judges? They refer to their territories by that name until the 10 tribes united. The most recent arrivals in Gaul were the Belgae, believed to have crossed the Rhine into northeastern Gaul in the 4th and 3rd centuries B.C. Now, I won't tell you tonight why the ace is still the most valuable card in a deck of cards. But I will tell you this, that Odin, the god of the Scandinavians, Woden and Wooten, can be traced to a chief of a tribe who came straight out of the area north of the Black Sea and brought a tribe into the area of the Vikings. They're just successive waves of the Celts. Caesar tells us the Helvetii were divided into four groups or Poggi. Among the Aedu, at least six are known. They just broke into tribe and tribe and tribe. The most legendary and ancient Celtic chief, Umbagot, was king of the Biturriges. It wasn't until Dumnorix succeeded to all the hereditary privileges of kingship and established hereditary kingship that it began to take shape. I'm not going to talk about him yet. Now, I'm skipping tonight because I'm really reviewing to bring us to Ireland. We've been going a lot of directions of late. Are all these people saying the same thing or not? Let's dig some more out. See what else we got here. We've got some more experts on Ireland and the Celts. I read you this before, The Archaeology of Ireland by McAllister. What's he got to say? Well, he talks about the beachcombers and the Beaker people and the early civilizations there. And ultimately, he's going to get around to telling us that the Celts showed up. Same. Okay, a couple of centuries before and the same span of time after the year 1000 B.C., the complex history is still and must for long remain obscure. About the beginning of the first millennium B.C., the tribes known in Egyptian documents as the peoples of the sea. Well, we haven't talked about them yet, have we? We haven't talked about the peoples of the sea. They're as mysterious as the shepherd kings, just peoples of the sea, were launched upon their several odysseys. Culminating in the settlement of the Etruscans in Italy, the Philistines on the coast of Palestine, the Achaeans and the Dorians were driven into Greece. I'll save that for a minute. The Trojan War, whatever may be the historical basis of that saga, was waged. The empires of Mesopotamia, of the Hittites, of Crete, of Egypt, passed as effective actors from the stage. And the two foundation stones of our present civilization, iron and alphabetic writing, were well and truly laid. The history of the Iron Age in Europe is divided by archaeologists into two volumes, entitled respectively Hallstatt and Latin. Here we go again. The Latin culture, considered to have come into being about 500 B.C., grafted on to the uninspired monotony of the Hallstatt, freshness born of impulses radiating from the Near East. When did this Iron Age come to Ireland? On these questions, there is at present a fog almost as heavy as that which shrouds the origin of iron in Europe itself. These must have been people of Teutonic or Scandinavian blood, tall stature, yellow hair, long narrow skulls, just like an archaeologist. There's nothing makes them as happy as a graveyard. What else he says? Don't go anywhere. See if he's telling us anything we haven't heard 100 times. So far, nothing. Yeah, he talks about the ring forts. Now, wherever Dan went, know this, they had no vowels. All they had was D-N. It could be Dan, Dun, Din, Don. Their forts were shaped like a D. Isn't that interesting? I mean, isn't that strange? D-shaped forts. We read you this one night. Where do we find them? Well, we reach the Mediterranean to find them, what he says. Driven step by step back to the western coast and the islands beyond, it appears they made their final stand by no mere conventional metaphor, but in grim literal reality between the devil and the deep blue sea. Nothing but massacre or drowning in the Atlantic deeps awaited them outside their island fortresses. Dun and Gusa, Dun O'Not, Dun O'Keel, Dun O'Connor, Dun Dun, Dan Dan, Donegals. Same message in every book. You're hearing it over and over again. Where did these people come from? They're Celts. Now we get over here almost to St. Patrick. Now where did they get their language, that strange language called Ogham, that they could put vegetables to it and have a private code? They could talk like watermelon, grapes, pomegranates, plums. And because they had worked it out in a numerical way, they could communicate. They could communicate with fingers because the letters of the alphabet were set up with lines such as this. That's Ogham. Where did Ogham come from? I'll read this authority on it. If we want to find an alphabet on which the Ogham may be supposed to have been based, we must find one with exactly the same selection of letters, no more, no less. There is only one such alphabet in the world and no other. I'm reading. There is only one such alphabet in the world and no other. Right there. See no other? The Chalcedic form, or the Celtic form of the Greek alphabet, current about the 5th and 6th centuries B.C. Now, what is the Celtic alphabet? If they're going to write Agios, holy, they'd write it backwards. It just goes the wrong direction. It goes from right to left. I picked up today in a bookstore the Genesis series of the Art Kroll Tanakh series, which has the Hebrew on one side, the English on the other side. Now let me move the book. Find some Hebrew words here. Here you go. Hebrew will be on the right of your screen. You're looking at the wrong side of the page now. Now, how do you read this? Normally, you pick a book up, that'd be the front. wouldn't it? Well, it isn't. That's the back. Here's the front. Normally you pick a book up and you open it and you got page one down here. Instead, you got page 809 there. You go to the back of the book and read like a woman. You got page 357 because this happens to be volume 2. They go backwards. So we have the Celts, for commercial reasons, adopting a Grecian language that ultimately in Ireland reaches Ogham mystery, and they write it Hebrew style. Same letters, they just write it backwards. The evidence piles up, folks. Only one. They have food ogham, bacon, olives, mutton, bacon, spinach. They have bird ogham, bittern owl, mallard, bittern sparrow. They have color ogham, blue, orange, madder, blue, scarlet. They could set up codes. It's a wandering people who must keep a communication between themselves, looking for a place to land. They land in Ireland. That's where they landed. I have the most famous of all these books, The Story of the Irish Race, for popular reading. Sumas MacManus. Mac is simply son of. My memory's correct. Now what does he say? The Irish race of today is popularly known as the Milesian race because the genuine Irish, Celtic people, were supposed to be descended from Milesius of Spain, whose sons, say the legendary accounts, invaded and possessed themselves of Ireland 1,000 years before Christ. Footnote, many scientific historians deny this in toto. Troy is myth, the Bible is myth, British Chronicles is myth, because I didn't discover it first, and I've sold too many books and got my professorial chair by writing a book and saying that Homer's Iliad is but a poetic discussion of the tides and winds in the Dardanelle Straits. So there's no Troy. Well, fly spit. It is nearly as inaccurate to style the Irish people pure Milesian because the land was conquered and settled by the Milesians as it would be to call them Anglo-Norman because it was conquered and settled by the 12th century English. The race that occupied the land when the so-called Milesians came, chiefly the Firbolg, did I tell you there is one historian that offers evidence that the Firbolgs were a sea-going group of Ephraim who left Egypt during those years of the Shepherd Kings and sailed west? Which is why when the Tuatha De Danann landed, their language was similar. I want to tell you that. The races that occupied the land when the so-called Milesians came, chiefly the Firbolg and the Tuatha De Danann, were certainly not exterminated by the conquering Milesians. The two peoples formed the basis of the future population, which was dominated and guided and had its characteristics molded by the far less numerous but more powerful Milesian aristocracy and soldiery. What if the Milesians were ruled over by a descendant of Zara? What if? Now, for years, they said the Firbolgs didn't exist. The Tuatha De Danann didn't exist. And maybe the Milesians didn't. Just like they said Troy didn't exist. They didn't know the Hittites existed. They don't know who the Sea Peoples were. They don't know who the Shepherds Kings were. And they thought Jacob's sons so powerful that, and Jacob so powerful that the land was called the land of the Hebrews, were a smelly bunch of shepherds with maybe a dozen tents, Raggedy Ann and down to Egypt. But archaeology has changed things since 1850. Now, the combined scholarship has this to say. Firbolgs, remember that. Fomorians were there. A baler of the evil eye. Hamitic people up from Africa. But who were the people that are predominant in the legends, quote, of Ireland? Firbolgs, Tuatha De Danann, Miletians. Call various things, now archaeology is finally able to produce this kind of conclusion. All three of these races, however, were different tribes of the great Celtic family, who long ages before had separated from the main stem and in the course of later centuries blended again into one tribe of Gaels, three derivatives of one stream, which after winding their several ways across Europe from the east in Ireland, turbulently met and after eddying and surging tumultuously, finally blended in amity and flowed onward in one great Gaelic stream. First time I've read that to you. They're all of the same. The Firbolgs, leaving Egypt about the time when the Shepherd Kings were in power and the Israelites dominated Egypt. The Tuatha De Danann, part of that Celtic tribe that comes across northwest Europe and lands in Ireland long before the kings of a possible Zara line come up from Spain and conquer the Tuatha De Danann and become the ruling aristocracy of all the tribes in Ireland. Now, if the Miletians were of the Zara descendants, don't look for them to come out of necessity, the ten tribes. The Scripture says they will be for many days without a king, but their Lord will go before them. And it's the Zara line or the Judah line and the Davidic line that must somewhere connect with the ten tribes, rule over them. And the Davidic line must always be ruling over some of the tribes. The 16th century scholar O'Flattery fixes the Miletian invasion of Ireland about 1000 B.C., ahead of what other scholars fix. He puts it at the time of Solomon. Some modern writers, including McNeil, say they came at a much later date. They did, take it from me. These Celts were eminently warlike. They came first out of that vast undefined tract called Scythia, a region which probably included all of southwest Europe and adjoining portions of Asia. Southeast Europe. I'm sure that's a typographical error because Scythia was north of the Black Sea. They came to Ireland through Egypt, Crete, and Spain. Now let me read you this again. There's no British Israelite. They came to Ireland through Egypt, Crete, and Spain. Firbolgs from Egypt. Tuatha De Danann and Miletians, I'll save them. They were called Gedho, because their remote ancestor in the days of Moses was Geodel Glos. When a child, Moses is said to have cured him of the bite of a serpent, and to have promised then that no serpent or other poisonous thing should infest the happy western island that his four posterity would one day inhabit. Niu, a grandson of Gael, who had been invited as an instructor into Egypt by one of the pharaohs, married Pharaoh's daughter Skoda, after whom Ireland was in later ages called Scotia, which simply means in Gaelic, nomad or wanderer. And the Irish Scoti or Scots are the descendants of Niul and Skoda. In Egypt, Niul and his people grew rich and powerful, resented the injustice of a later pharaoh, were driven from the land, and after long and varied wanderings during succeeding ages, reached Spain. And there's no British Israelite. When after they had long sojourned in Spain, they heard of Ireland, perhaps from Phoenician traders, and took it to be the Isle of Destiny, foretold for them by Moses. They worship Zalmoxes, remember. Chief Moses. Their leader was Milad or Milesius, whose wife also was a pharaoh's daughter and named Skota. Milad's uncle Ith was first sent to Ireland to bring them report upon it. But the Tuatha De Danann, suspecting the purpose of his mission, killed Ith. Milad having died in Spain, his eight sons with their mother Skota, their families and followers at length set out on their venturous voyage to their Isle of Destiny. In a dreadful storm that the supposedly wizard De Danann raised up against them when they attempted to land in Ireland, five of the sons of Milesius, a descendant of that ancient Israelite, healed. Oh, scientists and historians would never believe that Moses raised a serpent in the wilderness and healed everybody of snake bite. But Hezekiah has to destroy the old brazen serpent because they're burning incense to it years later. Now here in the legendary, quote, accounts in the legends of Ireland, mind you, one of those healed of a snake bite by Moses, over whom Moses prophesied and told him of an Isle of Destiny, his descendants are the Miletians. You know, no British Israelite wrote this. The family set out in a dreadful storm. Five of his sons were lost, great number of their followers, their fleet dispersed, and it seemed for a time as if none of them would ever enjoy the Isle of Destiny. Ancient manuscripts preserve the prayer that it is said their poet Amergin now prayed for them. Quote, I pray that they reach the land of Erin, those who are riding upon the great productive vast sea, that they be distributed upon her plains, her mountains, and her valleys, upon her forests that shed showers of nuts and all fruits, upon her rivers and her cataracts, upon her lakes and her great waters, upon her spring abounding hills, that they may hold their fairs and equestrian sports upon her territories, the annual feast days, that there may be a king from them in Terra, and that Terra be the territory of their many kings, that noble Erin be the home of the ships and boats of the sons of Milesius, Erin which is now in darkness. It is for her that this oration is pronounced. Let the learned wives of Brace and Buagni pray that we may reach the noble woman, great Erin. Let Aramon pray, and let Ir and Eber implore three remaining sons of Miletus. Eber, is that a strange name? Aramon and Ir implore that we may reach Erin. Innisfail, one of the many ancient names for Ireland, signifies Isle of Destiny. Leofail, the stone of destiny, stone of scone, all comes from an ancient Hebrew word, fail, meaning destiny. In the coming of the Miletians, more saying, they came from a land beyond the sea, and now o'er the western main, set sail in their good ships gallantly from the sunny lands of Spain.
Oh, where's the isle we've seen in dreams, our destined home or grave? Thus sang they as by the morning beams they swept the Atlantic wave. And lo, where afore o'er ocean shines a sparkle of radiant green, as though in that deep lay emerald mines whose light through the wave was seen, tis Innisfail rings over the echoing sea, while bending to heaven the warriors hail that home of the brave and free. Then turned they unto the eastern wave, where now their day-god's eye a look of such sunny omen gave as lighted up sea and sky. No frown was seen through sky or sea, nor tear or leaf or sod, when first on their isle of destiny, where great forefathers trod. They knew forefathers were there from Egypt. They knew the Tuatha De Danann meant exactly what it said, the tribe of Dan. Now, this author says, let us understand that the ancient historical legends of Ireland are, generally speaking, far from being baseless myths. The Irish people are a people who eminently cling to tradition. Not only were the great happenings that marked great epics enshrined in their memory forever, but even little events that trivially affected the history of their race were and are seldom forgotten. We know that way back to the remotest antiquity, the Shinaki, the historian, and the poet were honored next to the king because of the tremendous value which the people set upon recording and preserving their history. With details of a story, they were granted liberty. Big, essential facts had to remain unaltered. Every prince, every tribal chieftain had his own poet or bard who could recite from memory after 20 years training the history. And when they gathered at their annual feasts, the poets and bards of the other chiefs were there to listen to the accuracy. It was a major crime to falsify. Eventually they made land, these sons of Milesis. Eber, with the survivors of his following, landed at Inversini in Bantry Bay, afterwards defeating a Danann host under Queen Eiri, but losing Queen Scotta in the fray. Eramon, remember that name, with his people at Inverculpa, mouth of the Boyne. When they had joined their forces in Meath, they went against the Danann in a general battle at Tailt, routed the latter with great slaughter. The three kings and the three queens of the Danann were slain, many of them killed, the remainder dispersed. Of the Milesians, Eber and Eramon divided the land between them, Eramon getting the northern half of the island, Eber the southern. An oft-told story says that when Eber and Eramon had divided their followers, each taking an equal number of soldiers and an equal number of men of every craft, there remained a harper and a poet. Drawing lots for these, the harper fell to Eramon and the poet to Eber, which explains why ever since the north of Ireland has been celebrated for music and the south for song. Peace fell on the land then, and the happiness of the Milesians was only broken when after a year, remember those Celtic women? I started with them tonight. Eber's wife discovered she must be possessed of the three pleasantest hills in Erin, else she couldn't remain one other night on the island. Now the pleasantest of all the Irish hills was Tara, which lay in Ahriman's half. Ahriman's wife would not have the covetousness of the other woman satisfied at her expense. So because of the quarrel of the women, the beautiful peace of the island was broken by battle. Eber was beaten. The high sovereignty settled upon Eramon. It was in his reign, continues the legend, that the Picts arrived from the continent. Now, the chronicles have been mocked at. We read the British Chronicles to you the other night of the great-grandson of Dardanus, founder of Troy, a descendant of Zara, fleeing to Italy, killing his father in an accident, returning to Troy, discovering his people enslaved to the Grecian conquerors, winning in a rebellion, being granted 220-some ships, sailing, encountering remnant tribes of the Milesians in Spain, moving on and landing in the British Isles in England, pacing out the city of London that had as its original name New Troy. The chronicles were poo-pooed. Now archaeology may start paying more attention after Homer and after the digs are showing a habit pattern of deifying mortals, but a solid basis of history to be examined. It is clear chronicle record that about 585 B.C., a man identified in Irish legend as Olamfala by some, but a man of prophetic quality nevertheless, with a daughter of a king in Egypt, from Egypt, with an attendant named Simon Breck, landed in Ireland. This same Heramone, which is why I said that 1008 is off, this same Heramone, usually called Eramone, takes the wife of this daughter of a king traveling with this ancient sage, her protector. He requires that they name that hill that wasn't called Tara yet, that they form a school of the prophets called Mur Alam, and he brings in the power of that prophetic seer with a king's daughter. Now, was that Jeremiah? They still point proudly to the grave of Jeremiah. The Irish will not let you dig its sacred terra. Still hidden are the tombs that would reveal some of the secrets. 585 B.C. came with a harp, still on the banners of Ireland, and with a mysterious stone, still identified under Westminster Abbey's chair as Jacob's pillar, that in King Fergus' day went from Ireland to Scotland, then to England. Prince Charles will be coronated over that stone, still called Jacob's Pillar, made of stone not found in the British Isles, but found near the Dead Sea and in Palestine, with a great crack in it and with iron rings showing sign of much wear, having been carried a great distance. Yet it wasn't carried a great distance from Ireland to Scotland to England. The traditional stone of destiny, spell Leofail forwards or backwards, spells the same, meaning stone of destiny. Call all this chance? It's to these islands St. Patrick came. Who was he? You read this book, the story of the Irish race. I got every other page folded down, but I go back to it again and again. It'll be remembered that in the time of the Tuatha De Danann, their king Brace was deposed because he lacked the first essentiality of kingship, hospitality. Across this Irish community, they had public houses of hospitality called broons or breens. These breens also called breweries. You spell it in their dialect, B-R-U-G-H-A-I-D-S. Brughades is the way it looks like. Pronounced breweries. You'll know the origin of that name. A brewery was set at the junction of several roads, frequently the junction of six. It had open doors facing every road, a man stationed on each road to make sure that no one passed unentertained. It had a light burning on the lawn all night and a full cauldron always boiling on the fire and stocked with provisions of all kinds of plenty. Everywhere in the territory these were, but there were six chief breweries of Ireland. Clear back to the days of the Tuatha De Danann. These six chief breweries were asylums of refuge for homicides, I quote, like the six Jewish cities of refuge. Just too many shoes fallen, folks. Right or wrong? Too many shoes fallen to ignore it. Who was this Olam Fala? How'd he get there? Who were these Miletians? They say, well, they took heads. I already told you, that don't mean anything. They did that in Israel. Well, the Druids gave human sacrifice and offered children as human sacrifice. Well, hoop-de-doo. Here's God cursing those happy hookers down in Egypt, as I called them last night, a hole in a holabah, Jerusalem and Samaria, the two tribes, the descendants of Joseph and the descendants of Judah, even when they were in Egypt. They've committed adultery. Blood is in their hands. And with their idols have they committed adultery. And they have caused their sons, whom they bear unto me, to pass for them through the fire. The ancient Druid rite. When they had slain their children to their idols, then they came the same day into my sanctuary. They'd come to God's sanctuary and then slay children to idols. That's why the Jews have never found the lost tribes. They wouldn't be caught dead with them now. They're looking for Jews going to synagogues, reciting the Talmud. Here's what they look like. Divorced, outcast, not my people, scattered, not having obtained mercy, sacrificing to idols with one, children to idols with one breath, taking heads with another one, and worshiping God with another one. They're the same people, I'm telling you. Now, who was this Olam Fala? How did he get there? Who were these Miletians? Tell me that. What's the connection between the shepherd kings? Where did Zara's descendant and David's descendant meet up and form a kingdom? And Ezekiel did say, when that wicked prince Zedekiah is overturned, I will overturn, and then no more overturn it till he comes whose right it is. Zedekiah is overturned, that's one. If Zedekiah's daughters joined in marriage to the seed of Zara, and if Haramon can be traced to Zara, that's overturn number one. Fergus is number two when it moves to Scotland. The kingship in England is number three. You think I'm going to change being a Christian? We belong to the Christ race, implanted with his life. But I'll tell you this, Russia isn't going to overthrow that throne. We are in the last days, folks. That's what I'm preaching on tomorrow morning, 11 o'clock. Oh, by the way, I have something here. Hold it a minute. I like these Jewish books because they bring all the Jewish tradition in. They don't just read the King James. They're not sure King James is descended from Moses. I got news for them. King James can be traced to David. They talk about Joseph being appointed viceroy of Egypt. This is the book I want to read. Remember I told you about Messiah ben Joseph? You remember when I read in these books about Ezekiel, them looking for a Messiah of the Joseph line, who will precede the Messiah of the Judaic line, who will die in the Battle of Armageddon. It is time now to have a closer look at Messiah, the son of Joseph. Here's the Messiah text. It is time now to have a closer look at Messiah, the son of Joseph, to whom reference has repeatedly been made in the preceding chapters. I haven't read those to you. He is the warrior Messiah whose coming was predicted to his first ancestress, Rachel, when after years of barrenness, Rachel finally gave birth to a son. She called his name Joseph, saying, "May the Lord add Yosef," being add, "may the Lord Yosef to me another son." Genesis 30:24. Let's check that out, folks. See if we got ourselves number 37 yet. Or maybe 37, 38. Genesis 30:24. Got to take a little side road here for a minute. 30:24. I mean, are you finding things in the Bible that you just read right past? "She called his name Joseph and said, 'The Lord shall add," or Yosef, "to me another son.'" Joseph means adding. So, literally, she said, it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph, she called his name adding Joseph and said, "The Lord shall Joseph, Yosef, to me another son." Let's see what it says here. A Midrash fragment explains, "Hence we know that the anointed of war will arise in future from Joseph. And Rachel said, 'God hath taken away Asaph. God hath taken away my reproach.' Because it was prophesied to her that Messiah would arise from her." That's a Midrash. This is ancient Jewish sources. In another Midrash fragment, the two Messiahs are compared. "In the future to come, the anointed of war will arise from Joseph, and the Messiah who will arise from Judah," that is, Messiah ben David, "will be stronger than he." Messiah ben Joseph, also called Messiah ben Ephraim, referring to his ancestor Ephraim, the son of Joseph, is projected as the first commander of the armies of Israel in the Messianic Wars. He will achieve many signal victories, but his fate is to die in a great battle in which Israel is defeated by Gog and Magog. Then Messiah ben David comes. Scholars have repeatedly speculated about the origin of the Messiah, Ben Joseph, imagery, and the curious fact that the Messiah figure has thus been split in two. A prophecy of Daniel written about 164 B.C. is the earliest source, they say, 164 B.C. The earliest source speaking of... You want to hear more about your Messiah ben Joseph? We got a lot to do. Rachel and Leah were in competition from the beginning. God saw a hole in a holabah, the two sisters in Egypt, before Jacob ever prophesied the splitting of the birthright from the scepter. God never forgets any dangling promise he makes, because God's people have been so scared away by the excesses and the caricatures, Satan has always destroyed truth by misuse. The evangelical church has been so scared away from Scripture on this subject because of the excesses of the British Israelites, they don't know as much about the prophecies as the Jews themselves do on some subjects. And because the Jews have been looking for people like themselves, they totally miss the truth of Hosea, that it's while they are not my people, not having obtained mercy, and scattered, they will grow to a people. And where do they possess the gates of their enemies? When God speaks twice on the same subject, pay attention. Where is that promise? To Rebekah. When Eliezer brings her back to be the bride of Isaac, the prophecy, her descendants, to mighty nations and many kings, will possess the gates of their enemies. Again, it's repeated. What had been said earlier in the days of Abraham. Where have the Jews possessed the gates of their enemies? They never have. It's Ephraim that will do that. Where have the Jews become a commonwealth of nations? They never have. It's Ephraim and Manasseh that are given the promise of a multitude of people, a multitude of kings, a commonwealth of nations. It's over Israel David was promised to rule, not just Judah. And who is Messiah ben Joseph, and where's the basis for that? And who is that mysterious prince in the worship pictures of the last part of Ezekiel? He's not Jesus. Jesus is ruling and reigning throughout eternity. Yet they have a prince unnamed in the later chapters of Ezekiel. Remember that? Who is that prince? The Jewish tradition says that Messiah ben Judah, Jesus, the Messiah, King of Kings to the Christians, will raise from the dead Messiah ben Joseph, killed in the Battle of Armageddon, to be the prince, viceroy, as Joseph was viceroy under the Pharaoh. You know, I refuse to give God's word away to ignoramuses. God's too smart to be buried. I don't care whether anybody enjoys the Bible or not. I like it. I like God's Word. Now, these Irish have got to be pursued with fear and trembling of their terrible women. They got to be pursued. Now listen to this. You heard one description of the Miletians. Let me give you another one. Try this one on for size. The other one said their leader was bitten, oh, lost the place, by a snake and healed by Moses. Of the 12 Ionic states, one was Miletus, whose people were of the tribe of Judah and descendants of Darda, called Dardanus by Josephus, founder of Troy. It is a significant circumstance, writes H.B. Haney, that at an early date in the annals of Miletus, there is said to have sailed from its harbors a body of adventurers. These people were led by a certain Gedalias, Gadiel, or Galam, according to Professor Totem. The name Gedalias is the Latin form of Gadil, or Gadiel. In the form Gadil frequently used, its meaning is to be great or to become great, to be exalted, and in the plural, Gedalim, the exalted, the great, the fortunate. The Gedalians are said to have boasted that they were the heroes of Spain. Passing through the Straits of Gibraltar, these Miletians settled for a while in Spain and founded the city of Brigantia, whose people were of the tribe of Judah and descendants of Darda, called Dardanus by Josephus, founder of Troy. It is a significant circumstance, writes H.B. Haney, that at an early date in the annals of Miletus, there is said to have sailed from its harbors a body of adventurers. These people were led by a certain Gedalias, Gadiel, or Galam, according to Professor Totem. The name Gedalias is the Latin form of Gadil, or Gadiel. In the form Gadil frequently used, its meaning is to be great or to become great, to be exalted, and in the plural, Gedalim, the exalted, the great, the fortunate. The Gedalians are said to have boasted that they were the heroes of Spain. Passing through the Straits of Gibraltar, these Miletians settled for a while in Spain and founded the city of Brigantia. Now, if they were descendants of Darda, they were of the line of Judah, therefore, and descendants of Zara, right or wrong. And as Brutus, a descendant of Zara, out of Troy, in the British Chronicles, settled in England, this descendant of Zara, of the Judaic line, of Judah line, passed through the Straits of Gibraltar, settled for a while in Spain, and founded the city of Brigantia. Of these adventurers, the Irish scholar A.M. Sullivan writes in his Story of Ireland, quote, "The Miletian colony reached Ireland from Spain, but they were not Spaniards. Ibernia is but another distortion, as Eber is, of Hebrew. They were an eastern people who had tarried in that country on their way westward, seeking, they said, an island promised to the posterity of their ancestor Gedalias." Now, this Miletian record ties in that ancestor who was healed of a snake bite as a descendant of Zara coming out of Egypt's bondage. They were an eastern people who had tarried in that country on their way westward, seeking, they said, an island promised to the posterity of their ancestor Gedalias, still quoting Sullivan. Moved by this mysterious purpose to fulfill their destiny, they had passed from land to land, from the shores of Asia across the wide expanse of southern Europe, bearing aloft through all their wanderings the sacred banner, which symbolized to them at once their origin and their mission, the blessing and the promise given to their race. This celebrated standard, the sacred banner of the Miletians, was a flag on which was represented a dead serpent and the rod of Moses, a device to commemorate forever amongst the posterity of Gedalias the miracle by which his life had been saved. Irish chronology places the coming of these Gedalas about 700 to 650 B.C. I want to ask you a question. Do you think the great lawgiver Moses who put together all these verses and recordings that we call Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, do you think he was unaware of the promises to the house of Joseph? Do you think he was unaware of the promises to the house of Judah? Do you think he was unaware of the son of the scarlet thread, Zara? Now, does it seem unlikely to you that when Moses raises the rod in the wilderness and sees a princely son of Zara, whom he knows is of the tribe of Judah? Does it seem unlikely? Whom he knows has been preempted by Pharaoh. He's of the Levi tribe, the priestly tribe. Moses is. Does it seem unlikely that Moses would say to this healed prince of Zara, whom he knows must take second place to Pharaoh, yet his hand came out first, his father's hand, that is, Zara? Does it seem unlikely that he would prophesy over that princely son of Zara of an isle of destiny? Speculation, but not unreasonable. The records say Zara's sons founded Troy. Zara's grandsons, great-great-grandsons, in Brutus coming to England, found London. In the Miletians coming to conquer the Tuatha De Danann, bring the Zara line, placing Hermon on the throne. All we got to connect is the Davidic line, the daughters of Zedekiah, to marry Hermon, and the seed of David, and the seed of Judah, and Zara is elevated above Pharaoh to rule until the king of the Judah line, Jesus, again takes the throne. Who was this malicious king? And what about this record of Tiatephi, the daughter of Zedekiah, who travels with the prophet? For if Darda, the Egyptian, son of Zara, was Dardanus, the Egyptian founder of Troy, and if Chalcol, the other son of Zara, was the Egyptian blank, or Neul and the contemporary founder of blank and blank, and if Heman, another son of Zara, the brother of Neul, was the likewise contemporary Egyptian blank who inherited blank. And I know what the blanks are. And if Mahal, the son of Zerah, and the father of these famous Egyptians, was blank or blank blank, the Egyptian ancestor of the blanks, whose records full and complete enable us to blend the whole into one continuous recital down to the present day, surely we have the means at hand in blank, blank, and blank sources to continue out the record of the sacred chronicles. And don't you think we ought to do it? Huh? Yes, sir. Right now, Heber says.